Go ahead and turn to Ruth with me, if you would. We're going to finish up the book of Ruth today. I hope you have enjoyed the book as much as I did reading and preparing through it. I had never studied the book of Ruth before, and so it was a joy and a pleasure for me to do that. I've read through it, obviously, before, but it's been neat to basically study through it and to have to work on the lessons. Some things are harder than others. You know, you go through a book like Judges, which sometimes can be really hard, and we're going through Romans right now. Randy, me and Dustin are working through Romans for our next series, and boy, that's a challenge. And so it's kind of fun getting into something like Ruth, where it's a little lighter-hearted. It's a joy to be able to do that. So,
can't wait to hear Randy teach.
What's that? Oh, he's now starting to sweat back there. So we're back in the book of Ruth. If you remember the law, Leviticus 25 actually says or stipulates that when an Israelite runs into financial difficulty, it is his relative's responsibility to then step in and help care for him. And that's kind of what's at the background of what we're looking at here today. It was the heart and soul of what was called the kinsman redeemer, even though that's really not what Leviticus 25 is apart. Leviticus 25 sort of gives us the sense of the care that's supposed to be shown by a relative to care for those that fall on difficult times. And the whole concept of the kinsman redeemer, which we've been looking at through this book, is part of that, where when a widow gets into difficulty because she lost her husband, she has nobody to care for her, it is the closest male relative that's supposed to step in to then care for her and to provide for her. And that's been the sort of the backdrop of what we've been looking at here. So where are we at in our story here? Well, remember that Elimelech took his family, went away to Moab, where there was no famine, and they spent about 10 years there. During that time, Naomi and Elimelech's two sons had married Moabite women, and we know that all three of the men ultimately die, and it leaves Naomi and Ruth and then Orpah as widows. And as the story goes, we end up with Orpah going back home to her family at the urging of Naomi. But Ruth clings to her, we're told in the text, and follows Naomi back to Israel. And we remember that great confession that she had made, that Ruth had made about the Lord. Where do I go? Your people are my people. Your God is my God. And so we find that Ruth goes back to the land of Israel with Naomi and develops quite a reputation. All the townsfolk know of the care and support that Ruth had offered to Naomi. And as the story had unfolded, we find that on one particular day, Ruth had to go pick grain in the field, had to go and pick up scraps in the field. And so, as the text tells us, she just sort of happens upon the field of a man named Boaz. And we remember saying that that was really the author's way of sort of stressing, of all things, the sovereignty of God. It's almost a comical way of saying, yeah, she just happened to show up in the field that was owned by a kinsman redeemer. And so, as the story unfolds, we find that Ruth finds the favor of Boaz. Boaz treats her very, very kindly. He not only allows her to pick grain from the ground, but also has his reapers, his employees, if you will, pull stuff out of the stalks themselves and deliberately put it there for her to pick up. Plus, he provides her with an abundance of food to take home and take care of Naomi. And then we discovered last week in our story that when Ruth goes back home and tells Naomi that she's been in Boaz's field all day, we see Naomi sort of light up because she recognizes that he is a kinsman redeemer, somebody who's able to redeem her and her daughter, or daughter-in-law in this case. And so Naomi comes up with a little plan. She has Ruth go in and wait for Boaz to finish threshing the wheat and the barley, wait for him to fall asleep, and then she goes over and she uncovers his feet. She lays down next to him, wakes him up in the middle of the night, and she basically asks him to redeem her, the marriage proposal. And so Boaz, remember what he said? He said, well, I'm not the closest relative, so legally I can't do that. However, if he doesn't do it, I will. And so he makes a promise. He sends Ruth back home to Naomi. And Naomi knows immediately, because of Boaz's character, that he will do exactly what he says he's going to do. And as we've been talking through this story here, we recognize and realize that it's a picture of Christ in the church. Boaz is our kinsman redeemer. He's the one that redeemed us. He represents Christ. Ruth represents the church, the Gentile church, that needs to be redeemed. And so we've seen that unfold. So we come to the last chapter in this short story today. And it's where Boaz finally takes action. So go ahead and look at chapter 4 with me. We're going to look at the first 6 verses. And the first thing we see here is that this other kinsman, this closer relative, refuses to do what he's supposed to do. He refuses to honor the law and honor the Lord by taking care of and redeeming Naomi and Ruth. Verse 1 of chapter 4. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. Boaz then took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the closest relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." So basically we have the story set up here. Boaz immediately, the very next morning, goes out to the city gate, which is where most of your financial transactions would take place. It was a popular place in the city, but it's where a lot of the businessmen would hang out. So he goes there, that's where the elders were as well, goes down to the city gate, and he basically sits and waits until he sees this other kinsman redeemer come walking by. Other guy's probably a businessman, much like Boaz, so he expects him at some point to traverse that city gate. So he waits until he sees him, and then he calls out to him. And what's interesting about the way that he refers to him here, do you notice, do any of you have a little note in your Bible where it says, turn aside, friend, sit down here? You might have some notes there. What it's rather strange here because the phrase is literally sort of more like a certain one. So he sort of refers to him very generically. He says, come, a certain one, and sit down here. It's sort of an anonymous way to call upon this guy. Now, he clearly knew who this kinsman redeemer was, which means he probably knew what his name was as well. But what the author does here is he basically uses the equivalent of saying, come, John Doe, sit down here. And there's going to be a reason for that. So I just want you to remember something here, that this man probably has a name. Boaz actually knows his name, most likely. But the author doesn't let Boaz use his name here. Instead, he refers to him very generically as sort of a certain man or John Doe. And there's a reason for that in a minute. And we'll get to that. So just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, what the author basically did was Boaz probably used his real name. But the author refuses to put that in the story and instead substitutes John Doe, as if Boaz is not speaking to him with his name. And the author is permitted to do that because the author ultimately is God. And again, we'll get to that in just a second. So Boaz presents the first part of his legal case. Basically, he puts down these 10 elders, has the man sit down, and he spells out the case for him here. Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell a piece of land. It belonged to our brother Elimelech, and he now expects this man to actually purchase the land. Now, the text is a little bit unclear here. It's not real clear if Naomi has already sold the land or if she's trying to sell the land. And it doesn't really matter significantly. The bottom line is that if she had sold the land, what Boaz is expecting is that this other man will purchase the land back from whoever it had been sold to and bring it back into Naomi's family. If she hasn't sold the land yet and is intent on selling the land, then what Boaz is expecting is that you'll buy the land from Naomi. In other words, provide her with money to survive. Because right now, the problem is Naomi is poor. She has no way to take care of the land itself. She can't provide for herself and for Ruth. Ruth has been out there pulling barley off the ground to try to provide for her needs. And so Naomi finds herself in a difficult spot where she's forced to sell the land. And so she's either sold it already or she's trying to get it sold. And again, the text, the Hebrew text, is a little bit unclear as to exactly what's going on. I'm of the opinion that she probably hadn't sold it yet, but was desperate and needed to, and so Boaz was calling on this other gentleman to basically purchase it from Naomi so that she would not have to sell it to somebody else outside of the family. And we remember that part of the reason for that was the land was extremely important. It was part of Israel's inheritance, and each one of the tribes and the families had their own land. And God wanted the land to stay within those family boundaries. So if somebody sold land, it went outside their family, which means there's no inheritance to pass down to the children. And so God had set in place a system to where that would be protected. if an individual found himself in a spot like this and had to sell the land, he could sell the land to another Israelite. And that Israelite then would basically, every year, would have to basically sort of return a portion of that land back. Now, not physically. What would happen is the man would sell the land to the other Israelite, would get a sum of money for it. And each year that would go by, the land in some respects would be worth less and less to the landowner, so that after 7 years it was of no value to that landowner who had purchased it, and he would give it back to the man that had sold it to him. So, and that was mandatory. You had to do that as part of the law. Every year of Jubilee, the land had to be returned back. Now, if at any point during that 7 year period, after the man had sold it, if he could come up with enough money, he could buy it back from the person who bought it from him. But all the years that man had the property would be deducted from that. So say he spent $1,000 on it. Maybe you get to that the halfway through and it's only worth $500 now. The previous owner would only have to pay the guy $500 to get it back. It was God's way of protecting, making sure that even if you found yourself in a difficult financial spot, that land would always remain in your family. And so part of this kinsman redeemer here was to make sure that that land would stay within the family. And so that's really what he was calling on this guy to do. So he says in verse 4, "So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it," buy it back is the way to say that, "then tell me. If not, let me know, because I'm after you and I can purchase it." So the relative actually agrees. And what's really neat about this here is he's pretty emphatic about it. The Hebrew text actually says, I will redeem it. In other words, when you stress that pronoun, it's to show excitement. And so this guy looked at this and saw it as a great financial benefit for him to do. So he wants to buy the land. He's emphatic about it. Yes, I'll do it. I'll go ahead. I'll do it. So then Boaz actually moves into the second part of his plan. He deliberately left something out here. Probably because ultimately in his heart, we saw when Ruth asked Boaz to cover her with his cloak and to come into his family, he was honored by that. If you remember, the way that he spoke to Naomi was, "You've given me a tremendous honor here." And you could tell in that text that he was interested and eager in marrying her himself. But because of the binding nature of the law, he couldn't do it. And so what we find here is that in some respects, he's playing his cards just right. He hasn't taken the whole deck and put it all out in front of this guy and said, "Here's the obligation, you have to do all this." Instead, he only tells him about the land. And the guy says, "Oh, okay, yes, I'll go ahead, I'll buy the land." And then Boaz presents a second part of it. Look at verses 5 through 6. The responsibility of the kinsman did not end with just the land. If you look at verse 5, Boaz says, "On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance." So now he drops the other part of the plan, which is, well, okay, if you get the land, you also have to marry Ruth now. What's the guy's response? The closest relative says, verse 6, "I cannot redeem it for myself because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it." Quite a different response from the first time around. He was fairly eager to actually purchase the land, but he wasn't so eager to marry Ruth. But you notice what he says here. He gives us a reason for this, and it actually reveals something to us. The reason that he gives here for not being willing at this point to marry Ruth is he says he would jeopardize his own inheritance. And it's kind of an interesting phrase because it doesn't really tell us why it would jeopardize his inheritance. The only thing I can really think of is that according to the Old Testament law, when a man redeemed his widower's property by marrying her, the firstborn child was ultimately not his child, but the former husband that had died. But because the firstborn child gets a double portion of the inheritance, think about that for a second. A guy has his own children. Okay, maybe he's a widower. Maybe he's not. Maybe he doesn't have any kids. But in spite of that, his brother dies, so he has to then marry his wife. So he marries his wife. He produces a child. That child now really is not his own child, but yet he's financially responsible for it. The child is given the name of the original, what would have been his real father, if you will. But this man's now responsible financially for it. What happens when he has his own children? He's not going to split that inheritance, because part of his financial inheritance goes to that other child, since it's really his child, but the child wears somebody else's name. And so, does that get a little confusing for anybody else other than me? It's just, the only way we can really understand this is that the guy is simply afraid that because he's producing an offspring that will have his brother's name or his cousin's name or somebody else's name, it's sort of like a stepson in some respects. And he's unwilling to give up that because he wants it to stay to his real kids. Even though that's really his son, the son wears a different name. And so for some reason he says, I can't do that because my name's not attached to it. I jeopardize my inheritance for my real legitimate children. So there's a little bit of what I'll call selfishness here. It's quite the opposite of what we saw with Boaz in terms of what Boaz felt he should do. So we find that this man here is almost as eager to not do what he's supposed to do now as he was originally. What's interesting is, remember I mentioned he said, I will redeem it, and that pronoun was used twice for emphasis. It's done here as well, where he says, you redeem it, not me. And so he was just as emphatic now when he realized, oh, there's some kind of impact on me and my family now. So I'm not willing to do it because it's going to have some kind of negative influence on my own inheritance, what I get to pass down. And so he's just as emphatic in denying the law here in some respects as he was in doing what he should do. I think this is where we find our first clue as to why maybe the author refers to him simply as Mr. So-and-so or Mr. John Doe instead of putting his real name here. Because you notice every one of the characters, the main characters here, are given names. And they're all people that can be emulated. We should be like Ruth. We should be like Boaz. We should be like Naomi. Who shouldn't we be like? The only guy that doesn't have a name in the story. It's a little subtle tool the author uses to basically say, this man won't be remembered. Nobody knows who he is. And the reason is, he didn't do the law. He didn't do what he was supposed to do. So we remember Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, but we don't remember who this guy is, because he's not worth being remembered. That's ultimately what the author's goal is here. Why the author, again, refers to him simply as, oh, some dude. Mr. So-and-so. John Doe. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 25 with me. Whoops. Come on. Deuteronomy chapter 25. It says, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to strange men or to a strange man. Her husband's brother, the kinsman redeemer, shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him, and if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. So basically, what the author there is saying is that there should be a tremendous amount of shame cast upon the brother who refuses to redeem his dead brother's wife. That's Mr. So-and-so in this text. Again, why I believe the author leaves his name unknown. There's very few things that bring more shame than being forgotten in some respects, especially when it comes to Old Testament. Let's go back to the story here. We're in verse 7 now of the book of Ruth. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative, the one who refused to do what the law said, said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself." And he removed his sandal. Presumably he then gave that sandal to Boaz, indicating a financial transaction had taken place. Basically handing over his rights to purchase the land. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." So what basically takes place here? Well, Boaz's plan works out to his benefit at this point. The other redeemer realizes that he doesn't want to do what the law requires of him because it'll financially impact him in a negative way. And so he agrees to let Boaz then step up and become the next kinsman redeemer in the legal line, if you will. And I love the fact that we get a picture of Boaz's heart in this text. Look at what he says. "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all the land that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon." So he bought all the land from Elimelech and then his two sons to keep it in the family, doing exactly what the law says. But then he says, "Moreover." In other words, more importantly what I've done, however, is I have acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. But then he tells us why. In order to raise up the name of the deceased, in other words, the dead brother, on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from the brothers. We see this contrast between the former guy who basically said, "Sure, I'll take the land." "Oh, but the wife? No, I don't think so, because that's going to impact me. That's going to basically make it more difficult for me to hand down everything I own to my own kids. And you know what? To have his name on some of my stuff, I don't really like that. So no, thank you. I don't want to do it." But what you find Boaz doing here is saying he's doing it because he wants to raise up the name and a descendant for his brother. It's all about the other person. It's not about Boaz. We've seen that so far in this text, haven't we? Almost every action of Boaz has somebody else in mind and their benefit. There is nothing in the text that indicates a benefit for Boaz. You know, when you think about his field, remember how we said that the fields, that the when the Israelites would go out to take their crops, they would have to leave the corners of the field so that the poor could come in and take that. And so from a business perspective, that was a bad deal because you're basically giving up some of your yield, right? Which is why some of the Israelites didn't like it. And so it was a dangerous thing to go and pick in the fields because they didn't live by the law. What they said was, no, that stuff belongs to us. So they wanted to glean all their corners too and not do what the law demanded because it's bad for business. Think about it. If you were a business owner and you had to give away a portion of your stuff to the poor all the time, that's money out of your pocket, right? Well, Boaz didn't even think about that. What he says is, "Hey, even take the good stuff. Go right over to where the sheaves are. We've got everything ready, bundled up and ready for sale, and take the good stuff out and give that to her." Wasn't thinking about his business. He's thinking about Naomi, his responsibilities to Naomi and to Ruth. When he gave Naomi food to take home, one time 30 pounds, another time 60 pounds of food to take home to Naomi, he wasn't thinking about himself. So we get this neat contrast here where the first man has no interest when he realizes what the stakes are, if you will, but instead now we find Boaz basically giving us the primary reason why he's willing to do this, to raise up, it says, the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that his name will not be forgotten. So he basically does this in front of these elders, makes himself accountable, finishes the transaction. So all the people, verse 11, who were in the court, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give to you by this woman, by this young woman." So he does a number of things here. The elders, as they look at him, give him a blessing of fertility. They talk about Leah and Rachel. Well, Leah had 7 sons. Actually, she had a total of 9. 2 of them were by her maidservant, but she gave birth to actually 7 sons. Rachel had 2 sons as well, and so quite a bit of blessing in that to say, hey, may you be like these two people that basically founded Israel, was basically a blessing of fertility. But he also asked for financial benefit. It's funny how the first kinsman redeemer was all worried about the financial part of it. And what we see here is that now the elders, in sort of a prophetic utterance, pronounce blessings, financial blessings, on Boaz, even though that wasn't his first goal. So what prevented the first man from carrying out what he should have carried out was the blessings that were showered upon Boaz. Kind of a little bit of irony on God's part there. The second blessing obviously appears to be the progeny there. Perez was one of the sons of Judah, and which when you look at verses 18 and following, you'll see that his line goes all the way down to King David, which ultimately then leads down to Christ. In fact, why don't we go ahead and read that, verses 18 through 22. We're going to jump ahead a little bit here. It says, now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and Hezron was born Ram, and Ram to Amminadab. And Amminadab was born to Nashon, and Nashon, Salmon. And Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz, Obed. And to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David. So we see that their pronouncement of progeny, blessings to have children and a long lineage after him, came true. Because ultimately, Boaz stands in the line of Christ now, the descendants. So what happens? Well, we'll go back to verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her. And the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, the women said to Naomi, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons has given birth to him. So we see that God honors this, and ultimately Boaz and Ruth now have a child. They name that child Obed, which means worshiper or servant. The names in this book obviously play an important role, especially when you see here that it says that the women, as they cried out, expected Boaz's name to become famous in Israel. Remember, the other guy now is unknown. So we have this man, Boaz, who wasn't so much interested in his own progeny or his own financial gain, or possibly not even his own name to be remembered and known, gains all of these things as a result of his simple obedience to the Lord and to the law. His desire to see the name of his brother, in this case, not be wiped out because of some unfortunate act where he had died. So the women of the town shower praise on her. I love the way that it refers to Ruth here. Better than 7 sons, you know. What a blessing Ruth has actually been to Naomi. The last thing we'll just touch base on here briefly with this story is the fact that the last few verses here, 18 through 22, you may have a note in your Bible about verses 18 through 22 that it might have been added after the fact, or maybe somebody edited the book at some point. We're not really sure, but all we know is that God intended for that to be the ending to this book. Look at these verses 16 through 17. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then he had the genealogy there, all the way down to David, which ultimately we know, based on Matthew and Luke, goes all the way down to Christ. And so there's a number of interesting things here as we think about the purpose of this book and why it was written. And clearly, because of the author ending it this way, he wanted us to recognize and to see the importance of God's providential plan coming through somebody like Boaz. Think about what might have happened if Boaz hadn't done what Boaz did. We have this interesting story here as we look into where it takes place. We have the story of Judges, which is a terrible time in Israel's history. Constant disobedience, constant apostasy, constant judgment and oppression by their enemies. And then we get this picture of these handful of individuals. Just a beautiful, tiny, lovely story of starts with tragedy that gets, you know, brought back together in redemption and all that. But the most significant thing about the whole entire story is that it's part of the line of David. It leads to Messiah. And if you think about those different parts that are built into that, you've got this I don't want to say it, the path of salvation goes through Israel. It really does. But Israel was so rebellious and so disobedient, you have to sit back and think, how in the world did that ever happen? This is how. This faithful remnant of people that God had in His providence stuck in the middle of a terrible, terrible time and place in Israel's history, and yet God's plan to bring a Redeemer one generation through the next generation through the next generation wasn't cut off or broken because we had these individuals that lived the law, if you will, served God with the right heart and lived by the spirit of the law and not the letter of the law. And you see that in these characters. We look at Naomi, who goes off to a foreign land trying to find some relief, and her situation gets worse instead of getting better. Then we see Ruth, who is a Gentile, not even part of Israel's family, who somehow comes to know, love, worship, and honor Yahweh, to where she's willing to leave her people, leave her family, go back to a foreign land. And if we remember, she's going back to a place where it's going to be difficult for her. She's now got to work to survive. Initially, Naomi tells her, go back home where you've got a husband and a family that maybe you can marry and take care of you. And so her decision to go back to Israel, a place that's not her own, a people that's not her own, to a family that's not her own in some respects, she's looking at a situation going, it's going to get much worse there when I do it. But because of her commitment to the Lord, her commitment to her mother-in-law, she does it anyway. Let me look at this man Boaz, who has nothing to gain himself. He's already a wealthy, rich man, big fields probably, workers employed underneath his care. And this young woman comes to her and says, you're a kinsman. Marry me. And he looks at that as a tremendous blessing and opportunity to fulfill God's law in their lives. And sees it as an honor and a blessing for him. Again, he has nothing to gain. But that's not what he's interested in. And we get that shadow cast upon this other individual who refuses to do the same thing. And all of that, as those pieces fall into place, and you realize that this is really a story about Christ and the church and God's salvation plan. Remember, Ruth represents the Gentile church, which is us. Had Ruth not done what she did, had Boaz not done what he did, where would we be today? And so I think the reason the story ends on this lineage here is it's a great picture of God's providence and how God worked through a very difficult time in Israel's history through this small little remnant of people that loved him, that were devoted to him. And it's just kind of an interesting thing how all that fits together, and here we are today. We owe our salvation in many respects to the faithfulness of people like Ruth and Boaz and Naomi. And so we get this neat picture of God's sovereignty and His work through such a difficult time. So I hope you guys, I'm going to go ahead and just end it there. I hope you guys actually enjoyed working through. Like I said, it's been a pleasure for me to work through this. And Old Testament narrative can be hard sometimes because there's so many details and a lot of stuff. And this is kind of a neat little, just a short story. But I love the fact that we didn't plan it this way, but this ends right before Christmas. You know, the next 3 weeks we're going to spend some time looking at reactions of people like the wise men and the shepherds and Mary and Joseph and their response to the announcement of Christ coming. And it's interesting that this just kind of fits right before we start that, because again, that wasn't our plan. We didn't work it out that way. But it kind of ends right with that, and we can see how that kind of fits together as we lead into Christmas here.